ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Anthony Burke here, host of By Design, inviting you to check out our new Material Cultures. We're exploring how makers across our region let their materials lead. From bamboo reshaping what's possible in architecture, old timber transformed into contemporary furniture, to ancient traditions like batik reimagined for a new generation. Join me for Material Cultures on Anthony Burke's By Design on ABC Listen.
A hospital system in chaos.
Barely any fuel or power.
And almost no flights in or out.
Cuba has been brought to its knees by a US energy blockade under the fist of Donald Trump.
So is Havana on the brink of collapse?
And why on earth has Trump let a Russian oil tanker into the country? I'm Kylie Morris.
I'm Latika Burke. Let's go roaming to Cuba to find out. Hello, Kylie. Everyone's attention is on the Middle East and Iran, but it does seem there's a Caribbean nation we should just be keeping a very close eye on. And that, of course, is not necessarily Venezuela, but one that came to the forefront after the January raid on Venezuela, Cuba.
We're in the moment of a poly crisis, aren't we? Wherever you look, there's something to talk about. But I'm really happy that we're going to target Cuba today. It is a place that has long been the subject of blockades by the US and certainly a lot of vitriol and vitriolic rhetoric from Donald Trump and his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. There were expectations after Venezuela. He made distinct threats, Donald Trump, that Cuba is next and declared that there'll be no more oil or money going to Cuba. So we've been able to track down a journalist, a British journalist who's based in Havana and who's actually just taken on the monumental quest of traveling around the island on public transport at a time when there's virtually no fuel. But it does mean that as a result of that reporting trip, he's now able to share with us and with you exactly what he's seen close up on the roads of Cuba, inside the cities. How are people surviving? How much longer can they tough this out?
Yeah, I'm really intrigued to hear two things in this interview. One is who Cubans are blaming for this. Is it Donald Trump? I mean, we certainly are looking at our petrol prices going up all across the West and knowing there's one man responsible for encouraging or provoking Iran to close the Strait of Hormuz. Or is it the regime that they take their anger out, if any? And the other thing I'm really intrigued to gauge over the next few days and weeks is what happens in Iran and how that will shape or not what Trump and Rubio might do in Cuba, because I think they got very punch drunk after the success of Venezuela. That's when we first heard all the Cuba is next, we're coming for you. Will that continue after the Americans clearly overestimating their capacities in Iran and not preparing well enough for what they wanted to achieve in Iran?
They do seem to be testing again this strategy, Latika, of putting economic pressure via a oil blockade on the people in the hope that it causes some kind of transformation in terms of the people's attitudes to the leadership inside Cuba and whether or not it weakens the government in Havana. But we haven't seen that necessarily being successful in other places, and I don't think there are many indications in this moment that that is something that is developing or emerging from the current situation faced by Cubans. But probably the best way to discover all of this is to hear from our interviewee. Latika, tell us a bit about him.
So Rory Nicol is a journalist based in Havana. He reports for The Guardian, and he's just returned back to the capital after a three-day trip hitchhiking some 900 kilometres across the country from Santiago in the east back to the capital in the west. Here he is now.
Rory, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
So you've had this extraordinary journey. You've travelled more or less the entire length of Cuba in the past couple of weeks. What have you seen? What have you heard?
I went from, there's two major cities of Cuba, are Santiago de Cuba and Havana. And I decided, because I'd been sitting here just sort of writing away, phoning experts, that it was time to go and actually spend a bit of time on the ground again. And so I flew down to Santiago and spent a couple of days there because it's a fascinating city in its own right. And then tried to hitchhike and use public transport to get myself back again. Now, of course, we're in the middle of an oil blockade, so public transport is not good. And I didn't know how that was going to go. But a lot of Cubans move this way. You know, there's points where you can be picked up. If a car belongs to the state really is obliged to stop for people. So I just thought it'd be an interesting way to go. And so I took a bus for the first third from Santiago to Camagüey. And that was dead easy because you're only able to get those buses. These are the only buses that still exist. And you're only able to get them if you pay in dollars outside the country with a credit card, which pretty much wipes out nearly all Cubans. So that was sort of pretty empty, actually. And there was a couple of people on there, a beautifully dressed woman off to see her son in Switzerland. So, you know, people with family abroad, which is most Cubans now. And then I got to Camagüey, and then we still, the photographer and I really started hitchhiking. And then it got very, very interesting because we were picked up by a family in a refrigerated truck. Luckily, a refrigeration unit wasn't working. They were very keen we didn't use their names or take a photograph of the truck because they had borrowed the truck from the state. One of their brother-in-law had died in Santiago. There wasn't enough electricity in the hospital to keep him on ice, so they had to get down there for the funeral. So the whole family had jumped into their work truck, and they were picking people up on the way and taking quite a lot of goods in order to pay for the extremely expensive fuel now, which is running at roughly 10 American dollars per liter, so whatever that is in Australia. But this extraordinary journey that they tried to take over the course of a weekend, and they were quite interesting in many. This was a wonderful woman, the wife, who was the one that was sitting next to on these bags of charcoal that they were planning to sell. And she was a primary school teacher and really struggling. The schools aren't really open at the moment. And she was saying, the problem is now, because one of the things that I really wanted to find out was, because my line, the thing that I've sort of found living here is that depending on your point of view, you can blame either the Americans for the situation in Cuba or this moribund, very old men that now run this country, crumbling revolution. And if you're very left wing, you'll say it's the Yanks. And if you're right wing, you'll say Cuba communism never works. And so, but I had sort of come to believe that nearly every Cuban is having such a horrible time at the moment that they don't really care who's to blame anymore, and they just wanted to change. Now, having spoken to a lot of people on that trip, maybe 30 in depth, I'd say 28 of them said, we think Trump's an idiot, we care about the sovereignty of our country, but actually it's the people running the country that we blame. And this woman that I was on this lorry with was very interesting. She said, when you're standing beside the road, you will see these brand new Dodge Ram cars, these big Mercedes go past, and do they stop for us? No, of course they don't. And so that idea at the heart of this country that we're all the same is seemingly gone. And that was probably the biggest takeaway from this trip.
Rory, you've given some really vivid insights into how this economic situation is affecting people on the ground with that story about having to go and see the brother-in-law because there's not enough electricity to run a morgue. I wondered how bad you felt the situation on the ground more widespread was. And did you feel like this country is one that's on the brink of collapse, or do you think there's still a lot more survival in them yet?
Well, that's a very good question. It's sort of a very odd situation because, you know, it is a Caribbean island, and just traveling across the island, it was so beautiful, so beautiful. And, you know, people were outside their houses, they're in their rocking chairs. But, you know, it's a very odd place to cross because I saw endless fields being ploughed with oxen, with people behind. And, you know, there were scenes where it wouldn't have looked out of place in 1870s Kentucky. And while that is wonderfully picturesque for me, it is you know, those farmers would like to have tractors. So that's the sort of situation that we already sort of live with. But the additional thing is that people, there's about 40% of the population who do not receive money from outside, who don't have any income. And because of hyperinflation since 2021, their salaries and their wages are now down to under $10. Under $10 Australian a month, probably under $5 US. Yeah. And, you know, these new businesses where these fancy cars, people driving the fancy cars, these new businesses are selling food, but they're selling a bag of beans at $3. Now, if you're that's US, I'll stick to US dollars if I may. And if you're getting $5 a month, you're not buying much food. And if you've got no electricity and you put food in the fridge, and there's no electricity and your fridge doesn't work, and the food goes off, you're in real trouble. And then you've got a baby and you can't get any milk for that baby, and the electricity is not working and it's getting hotter because it's a Caribbean country, and your baby's not sleeping, or your mother with Alzheimer's is really confused and can't deal with the blackouts, you're really, really beginning to struggle. And people are there are people who are really, really on the edge. And I'm now at a situation where sometimes I'll take our rubbish bins down. I live in the top of, as you can probably see behind me, a top apartment. And I'll take the rubbish bin down and I'll throw it in, and there'll be literally people waiting there to go through it.
Rory, you describe these big trucks driving, you know, that your traveling companion was complaining about the fact that they weren't stopping. Does that mean that some people are getting access to fuel and others aren't? That there's some kind of monopoly by wealthier or more powerful sectors in the community?
Well, there are a little bit, but what's happening is that in 2021, private business was essentially allowed in terms of something, small to medium-sized enterprises. They're called MAPIMIs. These are people that could import things. And these have really replaced the bodega. The bodega was the old state ration place that you would go and get your rice, your beans, your cigarettes, your whatever else, sugar. And that would, when Santiago, my little boy, was born, they very kindly gave us a bath, they gave us some toys, they gave us milk. And he's only four, so this collapse has been really, really rapid and radical. So you have to start from the principle. This was a communist state. You know, Che Guevara said to the people, give up your personal ambitions, put your back into the common good, work for us, and we will look after you from cradle to grave. We will give you education, we'll give you healthcare, we will give you food, we will look after you. And we will give you work, and we will give you housing. And all that is now breaking down. And so because the government ran out of money and they couldn't pay for a lot of this, they allowed small to medium-sized enterprises to start. These are very smart businessmen going into it. So some of them are connected to the regime, and they have been selling. But if you're not getting any money, you cannot afford to buy there. And so that group has become extraordinarily wealthy in Cuban terms. And what was interesting at the end of my trip was that I got so frustrated standing beside the road. The way you hitchhike in Cuba is you hold a handful of Cuban pesos to show that you were prepared to pay. And this is usually like a dollar or something. Now, I'd spent 6 hours standing in the sun, so I held up a handful of US dollars. And there was this loud hissing sound as a massive modern American truck pulled up, and these guys climbed down. And they said, how much have you got? And I said, $40. And they said, yeah, we'll take you and the photographer. And we climbed into this air-conditioned cab where a beautiful, big, modern truck. And this, I said, who owns this? They said, Mapimi owns it. So this is the sort of future of Cuba. But the problem is that there's a lot of people being left behind. Just to answer your question about gas, all the way along the road, I saw people with big canisters of gasoline. They're selling it on the black market for $10 US a liter. So a lot of the people that picked us up were paying by taking money from us and then paying for the gas that way. How the gas is getting in, the Americans have allowed a very small amount of diesel and gasoline to be imported. But then, of course, last week, a Russian tanker was allowed in. with 700,000 barrels of oil.
So you're listening to Global Roaming on ABC Radio National with me, Kylie Morris, and Latika Burke. And we're joined by Rory Nicol, who's a British journalist based in Cuba. Rory, can we talk about that Russian tanker? Why was it allowed in, do you think? Are people surprised that this supply has suddenly arrived, given the kinds of conditions the Americans have applied really consistently for a very long time?
Yeah, I was very confused by it. I couldn't understand. I thought Donald Trump had the perfect excuse to sort of recreate the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, preferably without global annihilation happening. But, you know, he could have had the Atlantic standoff. It wasn't like he hasn't landed troops on Russian sanctioned tankers before. He did it on January the 7th. So I thought, why would he let it in? So I started phoning around a lot of people. And everybody was saying, well, maybe he doesn't want the humanitarian crisis to get so out of control that it becomes a problem. But that didn't feel, to me, that sounded a bit odd because he hasn't shown enormous humanitarian instincts up till now. So what then happened was that the Cuban government released 2,010 prisoners. And I thought, this is what's going on. This is it's a sort of negotiations are ongoing and these are little proofs of goodwill probably going on. Now you're going to ask me what the negotiations are heading towards, which is obviously, I'm afraid I really don't know, but my guess would be there's two options. So there's two options of what really I think. One is a deal is done, and that deal is a deal done with the authorities here. It may require the current president, who's called Miguel Díaz-Canel, to step aside. He is a party apparatchik. He came out of Villa Clara, which is about halfway along the island. He's not connected to the Castro family. And if that deal is done, then maybe people like the Castros, the various Castro members who are still around, can continue with their businesses. The businessmen who are already here can continue with their businesses. But the economy is more widely thrown open to American money. So that's one way it could go. But that, I would just say, will be pretty catastrophic for the 40% of people that don't have any money. And then the other way it could go is that this situation drags on to the summer when we are hitting 40 degrees. People are really suffering. We suffer more national blackouts that last for days. People come onto the streets. The government reacts with authority and force as it has before. And then you could possibly see the Americans stepping in some form. But I suspect that that situation is being adjusted as we speak, depending on what's happening in Iran, because how America exits from Iran will probably have a bearing on what they do here. Not that the Cubans could ever put up the resistance that Iran is showing.
So let's move to that. When Trump has repeatedly said, since Venezuela, I believe, Cuba's next. What do people in Cuba take that to mean? And what are the range of options?
They definitely think that he's coming for us. There's there's a very odd thing. And, you know, I think that Donald Trump, I think not just me, but I think most people think Donald Trump wants a win. He wants to be able to say, I took Cuba. And he wants to, we should believe what he says. He says that he wants to make Cuba safe for his friends in Florida to invest and to travel between and maybe have a nice house here or whatever they want to do. That's what he would like. And he would like to be able to say to the American people that I dealt with a problem that every president since John F. Kennedy has tried to, well, since Eisenhower has tried to deal with, and I did it. And that's what he wants, I think. But of course, he has a Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who is, his mom and dad were Cubans. He grew up in the Cuban milieu of Miami. He is virulently opposed to the Castros. And, it's part of his life work that the Castros fall. And he has the backing of many, many Cuban Americans in Miami. And he wants to see this regime fall. So those are the two different strands coming out of America.
And what are the military options for Trump? Ideally for him, I imagine it's a Venezuela-like overnight raid, short, sharp, surgical. But could it be something more?
You don't have that situation where you have a leader who, if you remove the leader, then the deputy steps in. And
So there's no Delcy in Cuba.
So, you know, there's no Delcy in Cuba. However, so I think it's much more likely that some sort of deal with the various, with the government in place. It's quite been quite odd and striking how many Castros have sort of emerged. So it's Raul's grandson who has been the front man in the negotiations, according to all the leaks. And that looks pretty certain. He's sort of appeared with the president of Cuba recently, even though he has no official role in the government. And that caused a lot of disquiet amongst Cubans, like, why is this man here? He's, you know, he's a businessman. He's head of security for Raul Castro, the former president of Fidel's brother, but he has no official role. So he appeared. Then the deputy prime minister is another Castro. And then, oddly, a sort of playboy influencer grandson of Fidel Castro did an interview with CNN the other day in which he said that Díaz-Canel, the president, isn't doing a good job. Now, that would usually get any other Cuban in trouble here. And he also said that the majority of Cubans want to be capitalists, which were both very striking things. So, you know, you have to read the entrails as ever. You know, this is, we're back to the Kremlinology of the 1980s and trying to work out what's going on. So I think there's, it's very little option for military options. I just don't, without actually sending in some Cuban Americans, or I don't understand how they will do it. However, I live looking over the sea, the direction the missiles will come and will be from over there. And so I may be proven wrong and I'll see a cruise missile going overhead, but I'm hoping that won't be the case. You have to remember that this disaster that the Cuban people are facing could be stopped tomorrow. This is not a natural disaster. It's not an act of God. This is a decision by various people to be in this situation. It could end tomorrow. This is an oil blockade. It is not a food blockade. I can still import a car from America right now. I just could not fill it diesel or gasoline.
And do people in Cuba consider that an act of war?
This has been a war by any other means for a very long time. The Americans have had an embargo on this country since the get-go. They tried to assassinate Fidel Castro many, many times. It's just, it has gone up and down. I don't think the Cubans think in those terms. The Cubans just want to get up in the morning and not to worry about whether their food's gone off. They want to get up in the morning and have a job to go to. They want to think about, you know, taking their kid to the doctor, and they want to just go and be able to buy medicine. They want to go to their job and earn a decent amount of money and then be able to travel on holiday. I mean, it's no different anywhere in the world. And the Cubans want that too. And they just want to be able to do what other people do, you know. So they don't want to plow their fields with an oxen cart and be photographed by people who have come on holiday and say they must see Cuba before it changes. You know, that's not what they actually want.
Rory Nicol, thanks so much. Well, Latika, I'm really interested in what's been going on in Cuba, and I read a lot about it and I try and talk to people about it, but I haven't heard anything really as detailed as what Rory shared with us there, in the sense of what it's like to be in the back of a truck rushing to a funeral of a loved one because the morgue doesn't have enough electricity. You know, the fact that the timetable is being set by things so out of your control, the people standing on the side of the road clutching pesos, trying to get someone with fuel to stop for them to get somewhere. And also that kind of two-step vision that he shared with us, that there are some people who are doing better, but there is also a critical mass of Cubans who, for whom every day is a struggle.
Honestly, listening to Rory speak like that, you could really feel like you were with him in that truck along the road, holding and clutching out the US dollars rather than the pesos. They were incredible insights, and from somebody who's not just there in Havana, but literally wearing out the boot leather on the ground, hitchhiking around. Hitchhiking also, it's a very brave endeavor, isn't it? But that's the way they do things in Cuba.
Yeah, and I think he gave us some insights too into, for example, we've all been a bit mystified by the arrival of this Russian oil tanker, as it seems has Rory. But he reads that as saying something about secret negotiations, right? That there is something going on. There are talks going on between the Americans and the Cubans, maybe with one of the Castro family. And there are other developments emerging, but we just don't have a full picture of what they might be. I also thought it was really interesting when you asked him about if the Americans were to stage some kind of a military assault, what that would look like, who they would target. And he said, well, who do you take? Like
who do you install, more to the point?
Yeah, who is the symbolic leader and who do you install? I mean, we should be very cognizant, I think, of the role that the Cuban diaspora in Florida is playing in all of this. I mean, what did you think of his assessment or analysis of the role of Marco Rubio?
Yeah, I think he made two important distinctions in that interview. One was the difference between Trump and his motivations about what he might want to do in Cuba and why and how that might affect how he goes about it, if he does. And that was largely, as he was explaining, for the benefit of his mates in Florida to invest in oil. And we saw that with Venezuela. So that's a straight replica, isn't it? But for Rubio, this is ideological. This is in his soul and this is a mission. And I think that does change the game somewhat about what we might see from them in Cuba. The other distinction I thought he made that was really important was that it was an oil blockade, not a total economic blockade. You know, saying, well, we don't need this humanitarian aid because I can still get the medicines fine. I can still get the solar panels fine. Sure, hyperinflation is there because not having oil pushes all those prices up, but we can actually get the basic goods. And I just thought those subtle distinctions were two things that stood out for me in that interview, because you could not know that really unless you were there living it and really experiencing it and bring it to life for us.
We always ask you in these episodes to please get in touch with us if you have any thoughts to share or any commentary on the kinds of information interviews that you're hearing. We do love your questions and feedback, so keep it coming. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au. And Latika, I don't know whether you've been monitoring the inbox, but there's quite a few emails about our conversation with Dahlia Scheindlin last week. So she's the Israeli pollster and analyst. I'm going to single out Judith, who wrote in and said, brilliant. Dahlia Scheindlin was excellent, so succinct. Thank you, Kylie and Latika, for proving Australia can have a discussion on Israel without disturbing everyone's sensibilities or being accused of anti-Semitism. Avoiding uncomfortable subjects isn't the answer to being fully informed.
I am going to give a shout out to Brett Coomber, Kylie. He writes in, it was an interesting interview with Dahlia. To me, Israel as a state is like a square peg being sledgehammered into a round hole. I can't help but see Israel like a child that has had a traumatic start and can't self-correct as yet. Also, Israel essentially represents the latest in colonial settler nations in a world that is pushing back against colonialism. But with wisdom and humility, things could change. We love to hear your feedback, good, bad, whatever. Keep it coming in. It's global.roaming@abc.net.au.
So Hamish and Geraldine will be back tomorrow, and they've got a really great interview to share with you, actually. Hamish has been in Indonesia and he managed to snare a sit-down chat with the Secretary General of ASEAN. And they had a wide-ranging conversation, not only about Australia's role in the region, but also, of course, about whether or not ASEAN nations might be able to work more cooperatively to manage the current fuel crisis. Thanks to our producer on this episode, Aston Brown. Latika, lovely chatting again. I guess we'll talk again soon.
See you next week, Kylie.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.